Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. I'm here at Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois, and it's going to be a great show for us today. We have as our guest one of the leading experts on free speech in the United States, Christopher Finan, the head of the American Booksellers Foundation for Free Expression and author of a brand new book on the history of the fight for free speech in America. We're going to be talking to Chris Finan today about his book, about the state of free speech in the United States, and we'll be taking your questions and calls as well. But first, before we go to Chris Finan, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. The FCC opened the door for an increased number of low-power FM stations last week. LPFM stations have between 10 and 100 watts of power and are run by nonprofit groups. There were several parts to the LPFM ruling, but the most far-reaching concerned translator stations. In 2003, reacting to corporate radio interests who complained that LPFMs could cause interference with their signals, Congress banned the FCC from granting LPFM licenses in America's big cities. The FCC then opened applications for translators so that existing stations could repeat their signal to fill in gaps in their coverage or reach beyond their initial broadcast area. Hannah Sassaman of Prometheus Radio Project explains what happened next.
They let groups apply for these stations, but a handful of fraudulent corporations applied for thousands of these translator licenses in order not to repeat local signals, but to repeat one satellite signal over thousands of radio stations nationwide and to build an empire of radio.
Oddly enough, those translator stations occupied the exact slots on the FM dial that the big radio stations claimed would cause interference if run by local LPFM license holders. This week, the FCC capped the number of translator applications at 10.
That means that hundreds of potential frequencies that were lost when the great translator invasion happened in 2003 are now going to be open again.
The FCC recommended that Congress should allow LPFMs to occupy those spaces. The Local Community Radio Act has been introduced in both the House and the Senate to do just that. Sassaman says public support is needed to ensure the bill's passage. For more information on low-power FM and how to support the Local Community Radio Act, go to PrometheusRadio.org or freepress.net/LPFM.
Last month, social networking website Facebook was met with a user backlash for posting information about what individuals are buying on other sites. Many members found out about the site's new advertising scheme the hard way, when the stuff they were buying on other websites ended up listed on their friends' pages. Sean Lane uses Facebook to keep up with his many friends and coworkers across the country. He was planning a big holiday surprise for his new wife, a diamond ring. He bought it just before Thanksgiving.
2 hours later, I got a IM from my wife. And she said, "What's with this ring?" And she then sent me a link, and it was the link to the actual product page of the ring. It showed the price, the percentage off, multiple pictures of it. So basically, the surprise completely gone. She let me know that she had seen it on Facebook.
Data mining is now practiced by most social networking sites. Lane considers the marketing of some of his personal preferences on the site as an acceptable trade-off for using the free space to connect with friends. But Facebook's new tracking system, called Beacon, goes beyond monetizing what is on their own site and inserts itself into other individual choices that are in no way connected to their Facebook page. When MoveOn.org heard about Beacon from their members, they started an online petition objecting to the new advertising program and called for a clear, simple, and complete opt-out option. MoveOn's Adam Green explains.
We realized that this was an issue that was much larger than just Facebook itself. It really was about who will write the rules of the Internet in the future. Will they be written for the benefit of giant corporate advertisers? Or will they be written in a way that respects the basic rights of everyday Internet users, including privacy?
Green and others who are fighting for internet privacy policy want consumers in the marketplace to assert their rights and push back on corporate power. 66,000 people have joined MoveOn's Facebook page, and more than 1,000 have written public comments.
The main goal of starting the Facebook group was to put some real faces and real voices on this very important issue and make crystal clear to Facebook and any others in the computer and technology industry that may be watching that people will fight back.
Facebook has responded. Last week, it made the announcement that it would not send messages about users' internet activities without getting explicit approval each time. And this week, Facebook announced a privacy control feature that will turn off Beacon completely.
I'm in my late 20s, I'm at an age where involvement in civil action and politics is something that I've always wanted to do, but I've always felt like it's not going to make any difference. So it's kind of cool to have your story make a difference.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national, nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. It is my pleasure to have a great show lined up for you today, but before we go to today's guest, I just want to make an announcement if I can. As you all know, back in October, we had our semi-annual pledge drive for Media Matters, and we had a terrific outpouring of support. But one of the things we've learned is that this program gets a significant number of listeners through podcasting and online. I'm proud to say that the program's the number one rated program in the Champaign-Urbana area for its time slot, which astounds me to no end, over conventional radio. But we also get an enormous listenership due to the computers and podcasting. And people listen to the show after the live broadcast. So we've had a number of people listen to the Pledge Drive show with Bill Moyers and John Nichols and Noam Chomsky and others. And then they've wanted to send in a pledge and get a copy of my book, Communication Revolution. We've been glad to honor all those requests. And I've spoken with my publisher, and anyone who makes a pledge by the end of the year to WILL, by the end of 2007, my publisher is willing to send them a copy of my new book, Communication Revolution. So if you're hearing this online, or even if you're hearing it over the air and you missed the Pledge Drive show and want to make your donation to Will, just go to willpledge.org, make your donation, and we will get a copy of my new book, a signed copy, Communication Revolution, to you. And I think it's a $50 pledge gets you a copy of the book. And for those of you out in podcast land who listen to the show regularly, please reward the station WILL that makes this show possible this week and every week, makes it possible for us to bring guests to you like today's guest, Chris Finan, like next week's guest, Paul Krugman. Week after that, Naomi Wolf. We've got a real John Nichols the week after that. These are guests that are only coming to you because of the graciousness of WILL AM 580 here in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. On that note, let's go to our guest today. Speaking of great guests, we have on the line with us Christopher Finan from the American Booksellers Foundation for Free Expression, and also the author of the brand new book from Beacon Press, From the Palmer Raids to the Patriot Act, A History of the Fight for Free Speech in America. Chris Finan, welcome to Media Matters.
Hi, thanks very much, Bob.
You know, I've had the great pleasure of reading your book over the last couple of weeks. And for the sake of our listeners, Chris Finan, what is the point of your book? Why did you write it, and what's your argument?
Well, my argument is that while many people think that we've always enjoyed free speech in this country because we have a First Amendment that guarantees freedom of speech and freedom of the press, in fact, it's a relatively recent phenomenon. I mean, there was widespread censorship in this country throughout the 19th century, and we only really begin to enjoy free speech early in the 20th century when people begin to fight for it, when the American Civil Liberties Union is organized and people recognize that it's not enough to trust in a constitutional amendment, that it's necessary to fight for it politically and in the courts and in the court of public opinion, because only as long as we fight for it will we enjoy it. We've made tremendous gains in the 20th century, but They've been wiped away on at least one occasion, and of course we're in danger of seeing it go away again today.
Chris Finan, in the title is the Palmer Raids. You say from the Palmer Raids to the Patriot Act, so you're starting with the Palmer Raids. I suspect a lot of our listeners, young and old alike, are not familiar with the Palmer Raids. What are they? Why are they important? Why did you start the book there?
Well, the Palmer Raids happen at the end of 1919, about a year after the end of World War One, and they come at the end of a really crazed year of transition from war to peace, in which there's a lot of economic struggle in this country. The unions, which had been sitting on their wage demands during the war, struck in the thousands. There were thousands of strikes in 1919. And many people began to associate those strikes not with economic struggles, but with a radical attack. They came, of course, against the background of the Bolshevik Revolution, which had occurred 2 years before, and the Bolsheviks' claim of that they would sweep the world before them. And many Americans believed that these strikes were part of a Bolshevik plot. And it was given some point and some substance, at least in their minds, when a number of bombs went off in this country in June of 1919, including one right in front of the house of the Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer. And that just drove the country into a frenzy of demands that the federal government act. And in November 1919, it did, and the Justice Department launched raids throughout the country, and an even bigger series of raids in January of 1920, which were the goal of which was to round up every foreign-born member of the Communist parties. There were two at that time, and to ship them back to Russia.
Two Communist parties or two foreign-born members?
No, there were two Communist parties. There were thousands of foreign-born members, and the Palmer Raids eventually incarcerated 4,000 to 5,000 people. The numbers, in fact, are not, it's not clear, but at least 4,000 members of the Communist parties were picked up.
And the book, a lot of your book, Chris Finan, from the Palmer Raids to the Patriot Act, the history of the fight for free speech in America, a lot of this book is about the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union. Could you tell a little bit about the history? What is the most important thing you learned in doing the research for this book that you think people ought to know about the ACLU?
Well, the ACLU is founded by a very small group of liberal to left people who had been busy during World War One trying to protect conscientious objectors and trying to protect civil liberties. The federal government during World War One really cracked down on civil liberties and for the first time becomes a serious threat to free speech in this country. And there are thousands of prosecutions of people for simply criticizing the war. People are put in jail for letters to the editor and for sending petitions to their congresspeople and for making stupid barroom remarks. In the end, more than 1,000 people are convicted of these remarks and sentenced to up to 10 years in jail. And one of the most spectacular prosecutions was the prosecution of Eugene Debs, who was convicted for saying to a group in Canton that you have nothing, you're made for something better than cannon fodder. For that, he is sent to the Atlanta Penitentiary, and that's where he runs for president the last time. But these widespread attacks on civil liberties finally focused the attention of this small group of the small band of civil libertarians, and they begin to organize and to try as best they can to oppose these restrictions. And though they don't have much luck during the war, and they're very close to getting arrested themselves, they open the American Civil Liberties Union in January 1920, and it's not just an important symbolic date. It is the opening of the fight for free speech in this country.
Our guest is Christopher M. Finan, the author of the new book, From the Palmer Raids to the Patriot Act, A History of the Fight for Free Speech in America, just published by Beacon Press. My name's Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters here in WILL AM 580. This is a live show. Our phone lines are open. The number 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Chris Finan, you mentioned earlier that there has been one great threat since the Palmer Raids that jeopardized freedom of speech in the United States since then until now. When was that?
Well, I would say there have been multiple threats throughout the period, but the darkest age of civil liberties since World War I is without doubt the 1950s, when once again the same kind of hysteria that occurred and led to the Palmer Raids and the so-called Red Scare after World War I occurs with far more force following World War II, which is a relatively benign period for civil liberties if you accept a couple of huge exceptions like the internment of the Japanese Americans. Perhaps the worst blot on our civil liberties record, and also one of the longest. It goes on for almost 10 years, and it's a period when people are put into prison for nothing more than belonging to the Communist Party. When we have a blacklist that bars performers in radio and television and the movies from performing based on their political associations and the petitions they sign.
You know, Chris, if I can interrupt you, this gets to an interesting question I had when I was reading your book. During the McCarthy period, clearly the government was harassing and arresting and investigating people for their political beliefs. But the blacklist, for the most part, was not the result of government action. It wasn't the attorney general. It was private firms that basically didn't permit people to have a gainful income working in their fields where they most of them had been very successful before or had been viably employed. How does free speech apply to the private sector in a case like that? When NBC says, or some film studio says, well, we're not going to hire John Garfield because, you know, he was at a pro-Spain Republican rally in 1938, so that makes him dubious. We're not giving him a job. But it's not the government. They're just doing it on their own.
Right. And there's a distinction. Not all free speech fights are First Amendment fights because the First Amendment, of course, just restricts government. Censorship, and so it doesn't. It's not by any means the last word in the scope of free speech and in the scope of censorship. And what you have to say is that that indeed NBC and CBS and the networks and the studios, they all had the right under our system of government to employ whoever they wanted to, just as. Just as Don Imus didn't have any First Amendment right to keep his job after he created a free speech controversy. But much of the drive behind Second Red Scare in the McCarthy period is actually provided by the FBI, and it's provided by their secret surveillance of American citizens and their vast collection of information about people's backgrounds and they provided these reports not just to government agencies, but also to people who then used them against private individuals. And so there was definitely a government component, even in the blacklisting that went on by private companies.
Was it primarily the movie and television and entertainment industries that were at the forefront of the repression and suppression of Americans, or was this across the whole economy?
Oh no, it was primarily government was at the forefront. It was the government who was deciding, you know, who was screening people for government employment based on their political associations, using those unfounded FBI reports to determine whether somebody would work for the government or not, the private sector simply followed suit and did what was in the time a very popular thing, which was to seemingly defend the nation at a time when it was threatened by communism.
Our guest, Christopher M. Fine, an author of the brand new book, From the Palmer Raids to the Patriot Act. I'm Bob McChesney, your host here of Media Matters and WILL AM 580. And the second half of the title of your book, Chris Finan, is The Patriot Act. And I think that clearly is the defining political act of our current moment for civil liberties and freedom of speech. And talk a little bit about the Patriot Act. What is its origins and what does it entail? Why should people who care about civil liberties be concerned about it?
Well, the Patriot Act was a omnibus bill, or a catch-all bill, and it contains many various provisions. It's hundreds of pages long, and it has been dubbed, you know, the Justice Department's wish list. Following the 9/11 attacks, Attorney General Ashcroft turned to his associates and asked for legislation to increase government ability to surveil and deter terrorist threats. Just about every thing that every measure or provision that the Justice Department had wanted and sought for unsuccessfully over the years in terms of expanding surveillance was basically thrown into the bill, and the bill was passed with almost unprecedented speed by the Congress. It passed within 6 weeks of the 9/11 attacks, and the efforts to try to restrict some of its broader powers were largely steamrolled by the overwhelming fear and desire to do something quickly about terrorism. And that said, there is a lot about the Patriot Act that is really not very controversial, even among civil libertarians. But there are a number of key powers that the government has obtained from the Patriot Act that give us grave concern. And I can give you the example, you know, from my personal experience. I work for a civil liberties organization. I work for the American Booksellers Foundation for Free Expression. And one of our biggest concerns is to protect reader privacy, to make sure that people can buy books and check them out from libraries and without the fear that the government is reading over their shoulders, because we know that if that is in people's minds, they won't feel free to check out the books and buy the books that they want to buy, and will have a severe chilling effect on intellectual discourse in this country. The problem with the Patriot Act, which I learned sitting at a meeting in Washington about 2 months later, was that it has a business records section. It's what it's called. In fact, it gives the government the power to demand the records of almost any organization, including not-for-profits, whenever it feels that it needs them for a terrorism investigation. Now, this lowers dramatically the standard under which the government normally has been able to get these records. In the past, it's had to be able to show that there's some criminal act involved and some criminal suspicion of criminal acts in order to get a subpoena or a search warrant. In this case, it's a purely investigating power, and the FBI can have it not only for the records of people it suspects of criminal activity, but of anybody whose information could help a government investigation. So the government in the Patriot Act gained the power to very broadly seek these records. It gained the power to do so secretly. The orders for business records are obtained under a gag that's imposed on anybody who receives the orders. And the orders also come from a secret court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, in which we have no access to in terms of challenging these orders. So we are unable to do what we normally do when we get a subpoena or search warrant, which is to challenge the government to make it prove that it really needs these records before we deviate from the policy that's designed to protect reader privacy. Cool. So that was our, you know, booksellers and librarians, mm-hmm. that was our biggest concern. There are clearly other civil liberties concerns in the Patriot Act.
Christopher Fine and our guest again here on WILL AM 580. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. And Chris, if you followed the presidential debates on both the Republican and Democratic side, that have already been many of them since the New Hampshire and Iowa caucuses and primaries have been bumped so far ahead. How has been the debate in your view? What's been the caliber of the debate on civil liberties issues in general and the Patriot Act specifically?
I haven't heard a lot said about the Patriot Act, and I think the best the best kind of measure of what's going on is that there is a bill. We've been fighting since 2001 to get changes in the Patriot Act, and we've made some progress, but a lot of our efforts now are going into support for something called the NSL Reform Act, which and NSL's national security letters are, again, secret orders that the FBI issues, this time even without a court, that the Inspector General of the Justice Department himself has acknowledged or is a power that's being abused, and tens of thousands of these are being issued every year, largely to Internet providers for electronic records. Anyway, the National Security Letter Reform Act, which was introduced by Russ Feingold, the only member of the Senate to vote against the Patriot Act, is co-sponsored at this point by only one of the current Democratic candidates, and that's Senator Obama. And and that's about the extent of it so far. A lot more was heard about the Patriot Act in the 2004 election than has been heard so far, at least to my knowledge.
One of the interesting developments in the past few years on the civil liberties front surrounding both the Patriot Act and broader questions of civil liberties or additional questions is the emergence of a self-identified conservative critique of the growing power of the state and the government. Bob Barr, the former member of Congress from Georgia, being probably the most noted person who went to work for a while for the ACLU to battle for civil liberties. And this is sort of striking to me because as I read your book, and as you already pointed out, Chris Finan, the ACLU was clearly driven by people who were from the left end of the political spectrum, who were certainly liberals and progressives and even socialists at times. Is this a new phenomenon, or has there always been a conservative free speech advocacy?
No, I think it's relatively new. I think there have always been some conservatives who would speak up for free speech, but in this case, libertarian Republicans played an important role in the move to push back against the Patriot Act almost from the beginning, and Democrats were not in any position to do anything very successfully in resisting the Patriot Act. But there were a couple of people in the Republican leadership, including Bob Barr, who in fact got the only limits on the Patriot Act that were part of it, and that was a commitment to at least revisit these vast powers that had been given the government to force the government to reauthorize these provisions of the Patriot Act, and that that sunset provision for these different powers really gave us our first opportunity to try to make significant changes in the Patriot Act, and those sunsets were put in by Republicans.
Again, our guest, Christopher Finan, author of From the Palmer Raised to the Patriot Act. You're listening to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. Our phone number, 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Chris Finan, this is a show on media. And you are concerned with free speech and civil liberties. How good a job do you think the news media in the United States does of covering issues like the Patriot Act, covering issues of civil liberties, of incidents, of people having their rights denied to them?
I think it's a mixed bag. I think it's been better in recent years, certainly, than in the first months and years after the 9/11 attacks. And I can give you a personal example, which was that it's 6 months after the passage of the Patriot Act, my group and the joined ACLU and the National Coalition Against Censorship and a bunch of other civil liberties good guys in holding a press conference to try to draw attention to the threats to free speech. And we had a great lineup. We had a great room in Washington. We were sure we were going to have a great press conference. And when we got up to speak, there was only one reporter present. And
from a union newspaper or a church letter or something?
Yeah, exactly. In fact, we don't know where he was from because he never filed a story to the best of our knowledge.
He was from a foreign paper.
Yeah.
I'm not joking.
Yeah, that's possible. We may not have seen all the coverage, but clearly all the reporters were over at the State Department. They were all over at the Pentagon. You know, the press follows the story where it sees the story, and in the early days, in the early years after 9/11, that was that was wherever the government was and whatever the government was doing. But that did begin to shift as we began to get some attention to our concerns. And then in subsequent years, and I'd say in the last few years, a number of newspapers and magazines have played a very important role in uncovering some of the abuses of civil liberties that have occurred since 9/11. And the New York Times exposed the spying by the National Security Agency, and the Washington Post exposed the extraordinary rendition program in the CIA prisons. There were a number of major breaking stories that that have helped to shape the debate on civil liberties, and so I think that that things are better than they were.
Do you think that the majority of American people, the vast majority, have the same support for free speech and civil liberties that you and your organization do, or do you think that it comes and goes and that there are moments in which the majority of the people in this country probably aren't that supportive of freedom of speech?
Well, I definitely think that support for free speech ebbs and flows, and the press, the press was in large measure following not just the story, but also the interest of the American people. And in the months after the 9/11 attacks, there was clearly an erosion in support for civil liberties in general. When fear is intense, civil liberties suffer. That's our history. But I do believe, and I do try to argue in this book, that there has been a growth in appreciation for free speech, even by Americans who, who don't work for civil liberties groups, or by the average voter. And and I think we've seen that at the same time that the concern about terrorism in this country remains very great, concern about civil liberties has also grown, and they're kind of in tension between each other, we can obviously expect that if there's more terrorism in this country, that we're going to be set back and we're going to have to fight all the harder, but. It is the existence of free speech groups and of a free speech community in this country that's committed to fight for these freedoms that ensures that people are going to hear both sides about the growth of government power as symbolized by the Patriot Act. There is a real institutional base for free speech in this country that did not exist 100 years ago.
Our guest, Christopher M. Finan, author of the book From the Palmer Raids to the Patriot Act. We're coming to you live in WILL. Our phone lines are open at 333-9455, toll free, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line 1, Champagne, you're on the air with Chris Finan.
Yes, very interesting talk. I wonder, though, it seems as if this that you're focusing mostly on the government as a trespasser of civil rights and free speech. However, it always has seemed to me that there's an undercurrent of Puritanism that we've had in America as long as we've been around. And Anthony Comstock was in business back in the 1880s, and before the Palmer raids, he had Margaret Sanger thrown in the clink, and that wasn't anything that came out of the government. It came out of, the popular culture.
Right.
And so I think, as Mark Twain said, Puritanism, there's always something that needs to be purified, and I think we have a long Puritan tradition that leads to this type of thing, and it isn't just the government that you have to look for.
Oh, I don't disagree with that at all. There clearly is a strong conservative element in this country. There always has been.
And I should add, Chris Fine, this is in your book, too. It's one of the themes you discussed.
Right. And we've had, just in recent years, going back to the 1980s, we've seen even many people who were admirers of Margaret Sanger and feminists who were sympathetic with Margaret Sanger themselves advocating for censorship in this country of so-called pornographic works. So that Puritanism, that dislike for sexually explicit material has also ebbed and flowed, and I don't see that ending anytime soon. We see it going on now with respect to the FCC and the FCC's crackdown on so-called fleeting expletives on in the media. That's an ever-present threat.
Yeah, one of our guests on this show, Bob Jensen, has been on several times, has a new book out called Getting Off. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
Mm-mm.
But it's a critique of the pornography industry, and it's very sympathetic to the position you talk about in your book of Catherine MacKinnon and Dworkin, which regarded pornography not as a form of speech, but as maybe you can help me here, as violence against women in and of itself.
Right, speech against it's not speech; it's discrimination, and that is a. There was a serious effort to try to get the Supreme Court to rethink its position about speech, represented by that, and not just with respect to sexually explicit material, but also with respect to the treatment of minorities and of hate speech, but fortunately, in my belief, that failed to move the court, and it continues to be protective of any speech that has serious value of one kind or another, even positive or even negative.
What do you think of the argument about corporations and free speech? Do you think that corporations have free speech rights like individuals do and should be protected from the government as individuals are from harassment of their free speech rights?
Well, I certainly... speaking as a representative of booksellers, I would hate to see booksellers' First Amendment rights infringed by government, and not all booksellers are small independents like my members. I'd hate to see the government dictating to Barnes & Noble or Borders or Amazon, what materials they should be carrying, or forcing them to carry material that they don't want to carry, or preventing them from carrying material that they do want to carry. There's always a danger when you give government the power to regulate free speech that there is a great danger when you do that. I think it's a danger that's greater than any danger that may be posed by the corporations themselves.
Well, what I'm curious here is what is free speech for a corporation? Is labeling of a product part of their free speech? Is advertising part of their free speech? How does one define that?
Well, labeling is a good issue. I mean, it's a good example. And there are areas of the media that are under tremendous pressure right now from legislators, you know, who want to restrict, for example, the sale of video games with violence to minors. And, they don't, in fact, have a right to, under the Constitution, to restrict violent material as opposed to sexual material. But many of the producers of these video games and recordings and other material that's controversial have turned to parental advisory warnings or ratings of one kind or another, and those are, you know, controversial among First Amendment types. But certainly, it is far preferable to strict government censorship of or coercion of those corporations. I mean, they do have that right under the First Amendment to, you know, to provide information about their product, whether it's in a rating form or a warning label.
But what about, I mean, in the real world of corporations and First Amendment and the U.S. Supreme Court, the effort to claim freedom of speech rights for corporations is used to protect their ability to have no regulation of advertising, so they can imply or, if not baldly, state something erroneous about a product. Do you think that is an appropriate use of the First Amendment?
Well, there is a distinction between commercial speech and non-commercial speech. I'm not really an expert in, you know, in where that distinction is drawn. In general, the restrictions on commercial speech have shrunk over the years, and if restriction on commercial speech were broad enough, you know, I think it would begin to lap over into non-commercial speech as well. So, you're right. The Supreme Court has allowed greater restriction on commercial than non-commercial speech.
You know, the other side of the coin, let me play the devil's advocate with you, though, on this point, Chris Finan, is that if the First Amendment is extended to sort of corporate advertising, PR, mislabeling, then the guts of the First Amendment, as it gets watered down, why should people respect it if it simply becomes a ruse to protect corporate power and prevent it from being subject to public regulation?
Well, I think the argument always is that the danger, you know, of government regulation in the speech area is always greater than the danger of free speech, unregulated free speech. That there's
I understand. But if they claim everything they do is speech, you know,
right?
Then suddenly their labor practices is a free speech issue.
I think they can claim whatever they want. I don't think that they can necessarily do so successfully. I mean,
well, they're doing pretty successful. They've got advertising covered now, which would have been unthinkable 40 years ago or 50 years ago.
Yeah.
Our guest, Christopher M. Finan, author of the new book, From the Palmer Raised to the Patriot Act, published by Beacon Press. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Chris Finan, the number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, the toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Chris Finan, you've also got a blog, which I was reading. It's at chrisfinan.com. Is that correct?
That's a website.
Website.
That's my website.
And at the website, though, you can get to your blog. And
right.
You've got a new group I've been following called First Amendment Freaks. Is that right?
Yeah, that's a self-created group. It's me and three other people on my blog right now.
Well, maybe after today's show, we'll expand the number of people. But one of the things that's interesting, because your book is on free speech, but you're a First Amendment freak. And as you know, the First Amendment has five components, free speech being one of the five.
Right.
And I was wondering if you had written, how does free speech relate to free press in your view?
Well, I consider them, you know, closely linked, and both of them vitally important.
But I mean, what is the difference? Why is there even a need to have free press, or is it implicit in free speech you automatically get free press with that?
Well, I mean, freedom of speech protects the right of all of us to speak, and mm-hmm. not just people who buy their ink by the barrels. And it protects bloggers, it protects protesters, it protects, you know, the general public, and the freedom of the press, you know, more strictly covers the the media companies that that provide the news that that we read. And, but I think, by the way, that freedom of speech, freedom of the press, is also increasingly protecting the rights of bloggers as well. The the debate that's going on in Congress right now about a shield law is one of the most important. One of the most controversial points is whether, freedom of speech or freedom of the press will cover bloggers in those instances, and not just reporters who work for companies.
Huh, that's, if I go back to the point you just made earlier, Chris, I thought it was really interesting. So freedom of speech, in your view, is everyone's right. Freedom of the press is those fortunate enough to own media corporations' right, but not our right.
Right, but obviously freedom of the
Do you think that's what the founders of the Republic intended when they wrote the Constitution, that we'd have one right for really rich people who own the media companies and one right for everyone else?
Well, I think when the Supreme Court makes decisions, it doesn't really make decisions under headings, like freedom of speech or, freedom of the press and freedom of speech. They're, they're talking, because freedom of speech is also obviously protected by freedom of the press. If the press isn't free, then obviously our rights as citizens are affected and limited. So, I think the two are so closely related that that they really can't be distinguished, except in the words of the amendment.
Our guest again, Chris Finan, author of the brand new book From the Palmer Raids to the Patriot Act. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is WILL AM 580, and the program you're listening to is Media Matters. And one of the other core freedoms protected in the First Amendment, Chris Finan, is the right to assemble. And how important is this for freedom of speech, the ability to assemble, to be able to communicate physically?
Well, I think it's very important, and I think it's one of the one of the rights that has been most affected since 9/11 by the practice of the administration of creating free speech zones.
Yeah, this is quite an extraordinary development. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Well, it simply has been, justified by the administration as a measure to ensure the protection of the president and the vice president by removing protesters from directly in their sight to some distant point where they can be controlled better. And the ACLU has filed hundreds of cases since 9/11, and many of them have been successful. But it hasn't had much luck in challenging these free speech zones at this point. Even though, if you're going to remove the protest so far from the site of what's being protested, it really loses its point.
Another thing, Chris Finan, has been the development of sort of shopping malls and commercial, privately owned commercial centers to replace town squares as the meeting place of Americans when they get outside their homes. Then you have sort of a conflict of First Amendment rights. You have the corporation's First Amendment rights, which you've already extolled or talked about, to do with its property as it wishes, in terms of who can speak and who can't speak there. And then you've got people who want to go to shopping malls and sort of talk about public issues as the only place they can reach people physically, practically in our society. Where do you come down in that debate?
Well, I think that I'm not an expert. I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not an expert on those particular points.
But I mean, it strikes me as that's sort of a front lines of the battle of free speech in communities across the country.
Yeah, and I think that there has been a balancing, that has been, that has been going on, and that that property owners don't have a complete don't have complete freedom to decide who can speak and who can't speak in shopping malls. And I know there have been, cases involving people kicked out of shopping malls for wearing T-shirts that the mall owners don't like. And, and I don't think that's right. And I think that, the ACLU has been right to challenge that. And as so often in, there are conflicts between rights that have to be resolved by the courts, and you know, I'm personally in favor of resolving them, in favor of more speech rather than less.
But I mean, in the case of a shopping mall owner, they say that you're expanding their speech at the expense of my free speech.
Right. And you know, I think that to the extent that, you know, a protest that's occurring in a shopping mall that is not disruptive of, you know, the mall's business is should be protected by the First Amendment.
Our guest, Christopher Finan, author of the new book, From the Palmer Raise to the Patriot Act. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air.
Okay, can you hear me okay?
Indeed.
Okay. One question, one comment. I don't understand. I'm not really familiar with the free speech in terms of corporate or in terms of advertising. Does that mean, my question will be, does that mean a company could put it has 20 carbohydrates or 20% this or something on a label and mislead that way, or is it just in some other sense? And the comment is, years ago there was a T-shirt listing the great religions of the world with a four-letter word. And if something happens, one religion said, if something happens, take a hostage, and another said, knock, knock, X, is something, you know. The shirt was taken off the market. I kind of think that was a bit of a restriction on free speech. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Yeah, Chris?
Yeah, Bob, I think you know more about the commercial speech doctrine than I do. I don't think you're still not able to advertise false, you know, false information.
Well, that's debatable, but probably not. But it would certainly make it impossible for the government to deal with false and misleading advertising, barring sort of a smoking gun.
Mm-hmm.
That would be considered their free speech right, just like you have the free speech right to give your opinion of the president, and they can't arrest you even if the people can prove it's wrong.
Right.
And if corporations have First Amendment rights, then they're entitled to that same sort of discretion you as an individual are.
Right, right.
But at any rate, if we can just, you know, we've only got about 7 or 8 minutes left, and there's a lot of ground still to cover, Chris Finan, that's worth taking up. And the issue of religion, which he just mentioned, is one that I'd like to talk about, because that, again, is yet another one of the First Amendment rights, freedoms that's protected by the First Amendment. And a lot of the attention of civil libertarians has gone to the separation of church and state and keeping that. And that has become a very live issue again. In our current political campaign era, what's your take on it now?
Well, that's one part of the First Amendment that we don't have much, and I don't talk about much in the book because it's quite true, as you say, that it's a very, you know, it's different than freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of petition. You know, it's you know, because of its involvement with the separation doctrine. But clearly, you know, we support the right of you know, of people, you know, to express themselves on religion, on religious issues, as well as on political, artistic, and any other subjects.
Americans have long thought, Chris Finan, that we have the First Amendment, so we've really got we sort of figured out the answer on civil liberties, and other countries are racing to catch up with us. After the Patriot Act experience, perhaps a lot of Americans or some Americans are being somewhat more self-reflective on these matters. Are there lessons that Americans could learn from other nations about civil liberties?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I continue to think that that the United States has protected freedom of speech more broadly than any other country in the world. But, you know, as you say, other countries have caught up, and even England, which is beginning to restrict its very potentially repressive libel laws, and begun to move toward toward the American model. You know, at a time like this, and there are clearly other countries that you know, that have freedom of speech, and that have a lot to, you know, have a lot to teach us.
Our guest again, Chris Finan. And Chris, if people want to learn more about you and your book, they should go to chrisfinan.com. Is that the place to go?
That's the best place.
And can they learn about the group you work with, the American Booksellers Foundation for Free Expression, there as well?
They can do that, or they can go right to the, you know, the ABFFE website, which is abffe.com.
And Chris, we've only got a couple minutes left, but I happened to notice while reading your website that you had been at the Wisconsin Book Fair and had been on a session with Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, who's been a guest on this show several times and who also wrote a book about the state of civil liberties in the United States today. And he was, you know, chronicled literally, you know, hundreds of examples of government and private sector, but primarily government repression of civil liberties since 9/11. And Matt argued that, you know, we were in very dark times, historically speaking, in this era in the United States. And I was struck by your response, which wasn't really that you disagreed with Matt, but actually you think things aren't quite that bad.
Well, I mean, I think that they've certainly been a whole lot worse. That while, you know, the cases, I've just finished reading his book, and there are indeed a lot of very disturbing things that have happened for a country with a First Amendment that's so proud of its First Amendment. But I still think that considering where we are in kind of in the cycle of fear and freedom, that people are still enjoy quite a wide range of freedom to speak, you know, and to oppose the government. And I think that they've used that power to draw attention to their issues. And we've done, you know, we've done the same thing with the Patriot Act, and we've managed to make, I think, important progress in limiting the Patriot Act. And the fight, you know, will continue. And it's happening in bookstores. It's happening in libraries. It's happening in communities across the country. So I think, you know, Matt actually says at the end of his book that he's an optimist too. It's just that it's a very it is a difficult time, and in times like this, people have to fight back.
You know, I'd be remiss in this program not to raise the internet and ask specifically if, in your view, the internet really changes the equation of free speech dramatically. Specifically, do you think that the internet, you know, sort of enables people to speak so easily that it really makes it impossible now for governments to censor as they have in the past? That it's sort of it's our get out of jail free card for the population.
Well, I don't know. The Chinese are doing a pretty good job of censoring the internet, and so are some other countries. But I do think that the internet has provided a platform that didn't exist before, and provided a place for individuals to speak and to draw people to their point of view that is unprecedented in its reach and its scope, and the Supreme Court therefore has resisted up to this point efforts to censor the internet on exactly that grounds, and you know we are continuing to fight that battle as well, but. At this point, we're winning.
Our guest today has been Christopher M. Finan, author of the book From the Palmer Raids to the Patriot Act, A History of the Fight for Free Speech in America, published by Beacon Press this year. Chris Finan, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Bob.
It's been a pleasure having you, and I want to just take this moment again to remind our listeners that 1 week from today, our guest live on the air will be Paul Krugman, the New York Times columnist. 2 weeks from today, we're going to have Naomi Wolf. And 3 weeks from today, closing the year, we're going to have John Nichols on. John Nichols, not in his usual capacity, trying to help me raise money during a pledge drive, but to talk about the upcoming New Hampshire and Iowa caucuses and primaries and the presidential races and give his take as a political reporter. I also want to take this opportunity now to thank Matt Kessler for running the board, my producer Andrew Boyle for his great work. And again, thank you all listeners. My name's Bob McChesney. I'll be back in 167 hours. Bye-bye.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
An ice storm warning continues until 6 o'clock this evening for Champaign, Christian, DeWitt, Ford, Iroquois, Livingston, Logan, Macon, McLean, Piatt, Sangamon, and Vermilion counties. A winter storm watch is in effect Monday evening through Tuesday morning for all of the WILL severe weather coverage area except Clark and Cumberland counties. Today in Champaign-Urbana, freezing rain and isolated thunderstorms with ice accumulation up to a quarter of an inch. Near steady temperature in the lower 30s with northeast winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. This is WILL Urbana.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. As the countdown to Iowa continues, GOP presidential candidate and former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee discusses faith, race, the Clintons, and the black vote.
I had Democrat state senators campaigning shoulder to shoulder with me, going up and down the neighborhoods in the African-American community in my election in 2002, because they said, Republican or not, I had done more for the people in the African-American community than my opponent by a long shot.
Also, commentator Eddie Glaude explores the recent surge in support for Barack Obama's White House bid. U.S. Treasurer Anna Escobedo Cabral explains her role in helping to curb the nation's housing crisis. Plus, Grammy-winning gospel artist Kirk Franklin shares his new CD, The Fight of My Life, this hour of the Tavis Mountain.